You're listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
Nicole Krauss, not Nicola Krauss, who is the author of The Nanny Diaries, of course. Nicole Krauss is the author of the international bestseller, The History of Love, for which she was awarded the William Saroyan International Prize for Writing, not to mention a whole lot of French awards, and Amazon.com editor's number one choice in literature and fiction. Her first novel, Man Walks Into a Room, was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Award for First Fiction and was selected also by the Los Angeles Times as a best book of 2002. In 2007, she was selected as one of Granta's best young American novelists. Her most recent novel, Great House, is climbing the ranks of the New York Times bestseller list and was recently announced as a finalist for the coveted National Book Award. Her work has been published in The New Yorker, Harper's, Esquire, and The Best American Short Stories, and has been translated into more than 35 languages. Can you even name 35 languages? She lives in Brooklyn with her husband and two children. In conversation this evening with Nicole is none other than Michael Silverblatt, the creator and host of KCRW's half-hour radio show, Bookworm, where he has been introducing his listeners to the work of new, emerging, and world-renowned authors for over 20 years. Norman Mailer claimed that the secret behind Bookworm's success is not only the public library, I'm sure, but that Michael is the best reader in America. I might add it's also because he is a very good talker and unpacker of ideas, too. In the case you have a hankering, the complete Bookworm archive is available online via KCRW. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the great reader Michael Silverblatt and the very great novelist Nicole Krauss to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Let me begin. You see, my child, a little bit every day I find myself contemplating my death, investigating it, dipping my toe, as it were, not practicing so much as interrogating its conditions while I still possess powers of interrogation and can still fathom oblivion. In one of these little excursions into the unknown, I uncovered something about you that I'd almost forgotten. For the first 3 years of your life, you knew nothing of death. You thought that it would all go on without end. On the first night you left your crib behind to sleep in a bed, I came to say goodnight to you. Now I'm going to sleep in a big boy bed forever, you asked. Yes, I said, and we sat together, I imagining you on a flight through the halls of eternity, clutching your blankie, and you imagining whatever a child imagines when he tries to conceive of forever. A few days later, you were sitting at the table playing with the food that you refused to eat. So don't eat, I said, but if you don't eat, you can't leave the table. It's as simple as that. Your lip began to tremble. Go ahead and sleep there for all I care, I said. This isn't how Mama does it, you whined. I don't care how she does it, I spat. This is how I do it, and you're not moving until you eat. You burst into tears, protesting and carrying on. I ignored you. After a while, silence filled the room, punctuated only by your little whimpers. Then out of nowhere, you announced, when Yoella dies, we'll get a dog. I was surprised, because of the bluntness of the statement and because I had no idea you knew anything of death. Won't you be sad when she dies, I asked, forgetting for a moment the war of the food. And you very practically replied, yes, because then we won't have a cat to pet. A moment passed. What does it look like when people die, you asked. As if they're asleep, I said, only they don't breathe. You thought about this. Do children die, you asked. I felt a pain open in my chest. Sometimes, I said. Perhaps I should have chosen other words, never or simply no. But I didn't lie to you. At least you can say that of me. Then turning your little face to me without flinching, you asked, will I die? And as you said the words, horror filled me as it had never before. Tears burned my eyes, and instead of saying what I should have said, "Not for a long, long time," or "Not you, my child, you alone will live forever," I said simply, "Yes." And because no matter how you suffered, deep inside you were still an animal like any other who wants to live, feel the sun, and be free, you said, "But I don't want to die." The terrible injustice of it filled you, and you looked at me as if I were responsible. You'd be surprised by how often in my little peripatetic wanderings through the valley of death, I meet the child you once were. At first it surprised me too, but soon I came to look forward to these encounters. I tried to think about why it was that you would appear like that when the subject had so little to do with you. I came to realize it had to do with certain feelings I felt for the first time when you were a child. I don't know why Uri didn't arouse the same feelings before you. Maybe I was caught up in other things when he was an infant, or maybe I was still too young. There were only 3 years between you, but in those years I grew up. My youth officially came to an end, and I entered a new stage of life as a father and a man. By the time you were born, I understood in a way that I could not have with Uri just what the birth of a child means. How he grows, and how his innocence is slowly ruined, how his features change forever the first time he feels shame, how he comes to learn the meaning of disappointment, of disgust, how a whole world is contained inside of him, and it was mine to lose. I felt powerless against these things. And of course, you were a different kind of child than Uri. From the beginning, you seemed to know things and to hold them against me, as if you somehow understood that built into raising a child are inevitable acts of violence against him. Looking down into the crib at your tiny face contorted by screams of grief. There's nothing else to call it. I've never heard any baby cry like you. I was guilty before I'd even begun. I know how this sounds. After all, you were only a baby. But something about you attacked the weakest part of me, and I backed away. Yes, you as you were then, with your fair hair before it turned coarse and dark. I've heard others say that when their children were born, they tasted their own mortality for the first time. But it wasn't that way for me. That isn't the reason I find you hiding there in the shallows of my death. I was too caught up in myself, in the battles of my life, to notice that the little winged messenger come to take the torch from my hand and silently pass it on to Uri and you. To notice that from that moment on, I would no longer be the center of all things, the crucible where life, to keep itself alive, burns most vividly. The fire began to cool me, but I didn't notice. I carried on living as if it was life that needed me, and not vice versa. And yet you taught me something of death. Almost without my being aware of it, you smuggled the knowledge into me. Not long after you asked me whether you would die, I heard you talking aloud in the other room. "When we die," you said, "we'll be hungry." A simple statement, and then you went on humming off tune and pushing your little cars across the floor. But it stayed with me. It seemed to me that no one had ever summed up death quite like that, an unending state of longing with no hope of receiving. I was almost scared by the equanimity with which you faced something so abysmal, how you looked at it, turned it over in your mind as best you could, and found a form of clarity that allowed you to accept it. Maybe I'm ascribing too much meaning to the words of a 3-year-old, but however accidental, there was beauty in them. In life, we sit at the table and refuse to eat, and in death, we are eternally hungry. How can I explain it? The way you frightened me a little, how you seem just the tiniest bit closer than the rest of us to the essence of things. I would walk into a room and find you staring at something in the corner. What's so fascinating, I wanted to know. But your concentration would be broken, and you would turn to me, a wrinkle in your brow, a faint look of surprise at being disturbed. After you left the room, I would go to see for myself. A spider web, an ant, a disgusting hairball coughed up by Yoella. But there was never anything there. "What's wrong with him?" I asked your mother. "He has no friends?" By that time, Uri had already befriended the whole neighborhood. There was an endless stream of kids coming in and out of the house for him. The only time Uri spent in the corner was when he was wrapping his arms around himself and wriggling as if he were French kissing. He would run his hands up and down his back, squeeze his own ass, and give a little yelp, screwing his head back and forth in an imitation that made everyone roll on the floor. But amid the laughter, you were nowhere to be found. Later, pruning the tomato plants, I came across a patch of the garden where you had mysteriously assembled little piles of dirt in rows, alternated with squares or circles etched into the ground with a stick. "What the hell is this?" I asked your mother. She cocked her head to study it. "It's a city," she announced, without a shade of doubt in her voice. "Here is the gate," she pointed, "and the fortifications, and this here is a cistern." Then she walked away, leaving me defeated again. Where I saw little pathetic piles of dirt, she saw a whole city. From the beginning, you had given her the keys to yourself, but not me, never to me, my son. I spotted you crouching near the hose. "Come here," I shouted. You lumbered toward me on your short legs, your face crazily stained from a popsicle. "What is the meaning of this?" I demanded, gesturing with the clippers. You looked down and sniffed. Then you squatted and carried out some lightning renovations, hurriedly sweeping, patting, refashioning a lump. You stood to examine it again from above, cocking your head at the same angle your mother had. "So that was the secret," I thought. "You have to turn your head at a special angle to make sense of it." No sooner had I absorbed this clue than you lifted your foot and with a few quick stomps leveled the entire thing and retreated into the house. Which came first? Was it I who backed away, or you? A strange child with secret knowledge that I came to resent, who grew to be a young man whose world was barred to me. "Do you want to know the truth, Dove? When you came to me to tell me about the book you planned to write, I was taken aback. I couldn't understand what made you decide to come to me of all people, me with whom you shared so little of yourself, whom you only spoke to as a last resort when it was absolutely necessary. I was too slow to respond as I might have liked. I couldn't change so fast. I assumed the old position, a certain tone of voice, a roughness that had always been my defense against all I couldn't grasp in you. To reject you before you could reject me. Afterwards, I regretted it. The moment after you walked out of the room, I realized that I'd lost my chance. I understood that you had offered me a reprieve, and I'd squandered it. And I knew it would not come again.
I've just decided that we're going to tell the truth about this novel rather than be dissimulating about it. What you just heard is a passage addressed to a character that 3/8 of the novel is addressed to approximately, and yet we never see him face to face. And I don't think he ever speaks, at least not in the present tense. And I think that the novel is very like that. For those who've read The History of Love, I think it goes further in the direction of invisibility and absence and providing us characters who we feel we know intimately, although we never meet them. And I wondered, I know that the first book is dedicated to your grandparents who taught you how to disappear. And
who taught me the opposite of disappearing, thank goodness.
I wondered how that comes to appeal to you as a writer.
The opposite of disappearing?
The absence.
The absence, yeah. Well, in the case of the character you're describing, and Dove, I mentioned the name momentarily in that reading, that was actually a character who was with me from the very beginning, and it was the idea of a fallen judge. I had been long obsessed with the film, the Kieslowski film, Three Colors Red. I mean, I love the trilogy, but Red, as a movie I saw whenever it came out. It was 15 years ago or something, and has stayed with me ever since. And I wanted to write the novel of that film in some way. And this idea of this judge who had been... Well, then, of course, I also read the Camus book, The Fall, which I'm sure that Kieslowski based that screenplay on. So the idea of this judge who slips and falls, who is in a position of sort of moral righteousness, and then fails somehow morally, was very moving to me, and I thought that this is the character that I would step into and embody. And instead, what that idea did was it threw this light, this sort of guilt over everybody else, and all of the voices that I began to develop became confessions, obviously not religious confessions, but confessions of the soul, I suppose, in some way. And this judge who was meant to be, who formed in a way the idea of everybody else, lost his voice in the novel. And I still think I might give it to him one day in another one.
That's very interesting. I think that many of us who've really been reading the important fiction of the last 10 or 20 years have been very influenced by certain films and certain tendencies in books. I know that you're an admirer of Bernhardt, where Thomas Bernhardt, the German writer, and in those Bernhardt novels, a character that we never see is addressed, as in The Fall, the Camus novel. This is a particular literary form. We don't know it so much in America. In France, it's called a récit, R-E-C-I-T. It's the equivalent, in a way, in the novel, of the recitative in opera. It's going to tell you what has happened in a way that you haven't approached it before. In other words, the objective telling is unavailable to us. All there is the private or the personal telling. And I wondered about that form because essentially this book is composed of a series of récits, people speaking to an absent one.
I think for me, the great opportunity of writing a novel is to step into the inner life. It seems to me there is no place else in life where we are given an opportunity as a reader or as the writer to fully embody the conditions of another existence, to become another. And I don't write third person anymore. I might one day, but it seems very... It's hard to imagine that I would ever go back there. I immediately want to get into the first person. And more than that, I want to sink very deeply down into, as far down as I can get into, that inner life. And so, for example, all dialogue was lost in Great House. There is, when people speak to each other, it's simply recorded as a remembered dialogue, and there are no quotation marks, etc., because I felt that that would throw the reader out of this very, very much inner sense of the meditative sort of life of this, the person, the flow of the person's thoughts. So yes, this, I think I felt the idea of, in any way, breaking this intimacy of this person confessing to another by introducing anything sort of outside of that would somehow lessen the intensity.
You see, when a book comes in to a publisher that they've been waiting for eagerly, I mean, they really do hold their breaths, they're very excited, but when it turns out to be not what they expect, they have a meeting. And at the meeting, the discussion is, how can this, although this is not what we expected, how can we present it so it will seem to be what other people expect when they hear there's a new novel? And so this desk that you heard about and have heard about and has been reviewed is really beside the point. It's a device. I mean, I don't even think it's a MacGuffin. I think it perhaps came as a bit of a surprise to the writer that the desk should have been made the hero of this novel. The novel is a very different kind of thing. Yes, it is interesting that this desk has passed, but it's not so much interesting as strange. It's eerie. The reappearance of the desk comes closer to an uncanny event than to a narrative event, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in all fairness to the publisher, I do think the book is difficult to describe. It's not an easy book to in any way summarize or reduce to a few paragraphs, and I can tell you as the writer, it's painful to reduce it to anything less than all of the words there are in the book. So it is, though, I suppose, particularly painful to think of this as a novel which is built around a desk, mostly because, frankly, when I was writing it, I thought of it as a book without a center. That idea really interested me. How can you build a kind of architecture? And I always think of writing as kind of architecture. How can you build an architecture where everything is pressed together, held together very delicately, but very solidly, without any kind of central pillar or pillars? So instead you have these joints or these echoes or these symmetries, or sometimes if I don't think of it as architecture, I think of it almost as a kind of moving body, sort of a galaxy of moving bodies that are held together by common emotional forces or by ideas, a feeling, really, a mood. And so somehow to offer up the desk, which is one of these many echoes, a loud one in the book, to be sure. But of course, in the jacket copy does say these stories are connected by this desk, and not all of them are, is the truth, yes.
And it's not a desire to be, unfair. This book is not difficult to read. It's difficult to describe. It's difficult to describe because in its two sections, essentially four characters speak in each of them, and you are, from the moment you approach these very particular characters, you're immersed in them. They're speaking as the father you heard was speaking, at a depth of emotion. In this case, he's speaking to a child that he hasn't seen in many years. The child has not only left Israel, in a sense, he's abandoned Israel, and on a moral basis. And the father, as so many of us late at night, is immersed in his monologue of the things that he could never say, that he would need to say, that he's not even sure he would want to say, that he would be in the most unprotected state if said. And so we are introduced to these characters at their point of nighttime vulnerability, almost always as if we are, if we were there, we would be intruders. The only thing that wouldn't be the intruder on such a scene is the bed or the desk. And so, it is natural for the desk to be mentioned because much of this novel is about solitariness and how, when you feel that you've parented incorrectly or loved incorrectly, you're frequently alone to feel it.
Yeah, I do. I'm told often, and I think there's truth to it, that all of the characters that I've written, really across all three novels, are incredibly solitary or sort of isolated or even in some cases very alienated from the rest of the world. And yet what interests me about them is not their solitude, actually. It's the starting point. What interests me is this tremendous effort or this sort of labor to become known, to be fully exposed to another. And so the point is that, yes, you are really in this, the kind of abyss that these characters have slipped into, these kind of tender or fragile fissures where they are, where you find them sort of kneel down at their bottom, but they are addressing another. And that is the first point of desire, to explain, to unburden, to be seen. In fact, when I began Great House, I started with, I actually wrote a short story, and that was called, well, the desk began there, that my problems began there with the desk, because it was called From the Desk of Daniel Varsky, and it was published as such. And I went back to that story because I couldn't stop thinking about it, and maybe a year after it was published. And the first thing I did when I returned to the story is to put two words in the beginning of it, and those words were, Your Honor. Simply, Your Honor. I didn't know why. I mean, I had the judge in my mind, but I didn't know who the judge would be. He hadn't been invented yet in the novel itself. There was no novel. There was just a short story. And the moment I put those two words there, there was a kind of bristling. There's a moment that you begin to know as a writer, although it's rare, but it's the critical moment. You have to seize it when it comes, which is the moment the kind of the mortal breath is really blown into the character, into the story. And somehow, as soon as I put those two words there, as soon as she was, Nadia is her name, this American writer, a novelist about 50 years old, as soon as she was addressing this other, whoever he was, with those words, I knew so many things about her. I sensed her uncertainty, her doubt, her guilt, all of those things, and her need to be seen, you know, her whole confession, in a way, sort of flashed before my eyes before I even know what it was going to be. So I think that, yeah, that is critical to me.
An interesting thing here. Over the last 6 months, I got old. I really wasn't expecting it.
Me too.
Tired around the knees, unhappy in the elbows, funny in the glasses. The Gursky, too, you seem to have a very deep perception of what it is to be older and alone. And I wondered, although it is not relevant to a novel, to ask a writer about personal life, but I wondered where that familiarity might come from.
I often find myself saying, I found myself saying this a lot when I spoke to readers who had read The History of Love and who would ask me, oh, is Leo Gursky based on your grandfather? And I would always have to say, absolutely not at all. I would always have to say, he's me. I mean, he feels like me. So then the obvious leap is to simply just begin the answer of that question with, I must be an old man inside. And I think somehow, you know, we talked about the absence of something, and it's in a way it's easier to write about a thing by writing about its absence. I've sensed that, I felt that very early on as a writer. So to write about what it is to feel apart in the world as a young woman, let's say, it's hard to do that in a way because I know it well, because it's an intimate and familiar thing, and also because it didn't allow me to shine the light on it in a way that would allow me to take a leap, an imaginative leap, so that I could then turn around and write about the truth. Somehow to become the thing which on the surface I am not, and to cast my voice at the other end of life, pressed up against death, I mean, that naturally then I could just expose sort of vast portions of how I might think or feel in the world. Leo, from the start, was a failed writer, and I had just published my first novel, and although it wasn't a failure, I had many, you know, nothing changed or stopped. The world continued in all the ways it had before, and I didn't expect it to stop, but somehow I needed some sense of why it wouldn't be an indulgence to go on. And I began to think about this question of how many readers is enough readers. What if you wrote a book that just affected one or two lives, but affected them so profoundly that it changed everything? And also this question of what does it mean to want to be seen? I mean, Leo knocks over things in a Starbucks. That isn't my instinct. But obviously to write is to want to be seen, to want to be fully exposed in some way. So I think somehow by and being pressed up against death, that to me comes totally naturally. Obviously, I mean, from the section I read tonight, this is something often on my mind, and it doesn't, turns out one doesn't need to be old to be constantly contemplating anew the possibility of one's own death, or when one has children, of death in a much more frightening way.
I found myself feeling, you see, secretly, most of the time when something, when we're confessed to by a very vulnerable person, it's in the act of reading. We're holding a book and the book is talking to us. And so in a peculiar way, each of these sections, these people, are deeply related to us because they are speaking to us as in a book, and they are in a book. So their submersion is double in a peculiar way. And I don't know, I often want to ask people, because, you know, this is reading, what I spend most of my time doing, and I have the general feeling, if what they say about the culture in newspapers is true, that this isn't true of other people anymore. It once was. It once was that the majority of one's time, when one wasn't working or being with one's family, reading. It was so common, and our ears grew attuned to the beauties of being spoken to silently by a book. And I'd say that that's an experience that this book particularly enshrines, that silent dialogue between a book and you, the reader.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I've staked my life on that idea that that is what life should be and should involve, is tremendous amounts of reading. And also, as I said earlier, that reading affords us this unique opportunity. And it seems not by accident that actually literature has been a character in certainly the last two novels, and in certain ways, now that I think about it, of Man Walks Into a Room, my first novel as well, which is really about this notion of what is true empathy and how can we achieve it. And of course, to me, the idea of being allowed to step into another's life, to feel what it is to be him or her, naturally leads one, I think, it's been my experience as a reader, to compassion, to empathy, to understand what that would mean. So I certainly feel somehow, you know, in the history of love, which was built around the idea of this book that changed these few people's lives and connected them. And of course, all of my feeling for literature was absorbed like a sponge into this object. I don't think that they describe that book on the flap copy as a bunch of stories surrounded by or connected by a book, but they could have, I suppose. And the same in a way with the desk here. Again, yes, it doesn't need to mean much, and it also means everything. But here you have this object that, again, people are laboring to write at, to sort of to express themselves at.
I came to feel then, you know, because I want to not only particularize a reading experience, but always in talking to the writer, I want to figure out the way in which the reading experience is particular to that writer and that writer alone. And as I was reading, I realized every time I'd put the book down, it would completely fly from my head. Now, I'm not talking about something silly or insulting. It would never be my interest to do that. I mean that the book has been constructed so that when you're not with it, it leaves you. The characters' names, as you heard in the section, are mentioned only a few times. You really have to scratch your head and go back to the page where that character was named. In the first chapter, the speaker is only named once, and it's a 43-page section. It's quite bravura, in fact, to realize you're reading so much about a character who's not even named, you know?
People don't name themselves. For example, when I open The History of Love, you have Leo Gursky announcing himself, introducing him to you, because that was performance, and he was aware of a kind of audience and of wanting to charm and to make laugh and to be loved. But here, none of that interested me anymore. And it may interest me again, I'm sure it will in other books, but here what interested me again was this sense of an absolutely fully saturated attention, unbroken, to reflect on the life, you know, of these characters. And so to say, hello, my name is so-and-so, would immediately break that before I had ever achieved it. And so I was aware for a long time that I was writing a character without a name, because almost to name her, and in the end I did, her name is Nadia, but I kept coming up with names and they were all wrong. They fractured the glass. I mean, the glass was sort of broken as soon as I would give her a name. And in the end, her name came very accidentally, and it came because her husband, and she leaves him, he leaves her, because she's committed herself so completely to her art, to writing, that she no longer really knows how to have a relationship with anyone. And he says to her, Nada, that's his sort of nickname for her.
Nothing.
And then her name was born, Nadia. And again, with the other characters, I only wish to use their name when they themselves might have used it. And I wasn't interested, again, in this novel, in kind of the ease, necessarily, of the reading experience. But I had the sense that I wanted you readers, to become lost in these characters, to feel that you were them, to become them yourselves. So you wouldn't need a name.
And, you know, when you go to Dickens because no one but Dickens can give you a Dickens character. And no one but Faulkner can give you a Faulkner character. I mean, one of the ways in which we still come to an evaluation of the writers is, are their characters indelibly theirs? And I think Nicole Krauss's are, that the four voices and the seven or eight more people in this novel are themselves so fully that you can't imagine them in the hands of another writer.
Thank you. I did feel writing them that it was absolutely a discovery, so that in the beginning, when I first began the first pages of each one, I had no sense of who they would become or why they would be that way. For example, the father, Aaron, who you heard from tonight, his story opened with him. He mentions in that section that his son had wanted to be a writer. And his story simply opened with an idea I had. In fact, I thought I was going to write this novel for a while. The idea of a novel about a shark in an illuminated tank who is connected by wires and tubes and electrodes to these dreamers sleeping in other rooms. And the dreamers channel their sadness into this great white beast who absorbs all this human sadness. And so the sun, it opens that one with the sun coming to him and saying, I'm going to write this novel about this shark and these people. And this father quite cruelly says, who are these people? You know, what is this little story of yours? And goes from there. And I thought, who is this father who seems so cruel, and yet I feel something for him, or something tells me that I will be moved by him, and I can't say why. And it took this long journey of writing him to get to the part that I read to you tonight, which is to realize here is a man, here is a father, who all his life felt that his son had turned against him, had chosen the mother over him. The son had turned his back, and though a greater man or greater father may have still made the effort, he felt, I think, as many of us might, sort of rejected and angry and himself sort of stepped away. So this was a long process of discovery. Then there's a case of another character who we haven't mentioned at all tonight, but there's a story told to you in the voice of a man called Arthur, and he's a retired Oxford professor living in London, and he's telling you really the story of his wife, Lottie Berg, who is this German Jewish refugee and she becomes a writer, not well known. And all his life he lives with her, and yet she remained a mystery to him. But I didn't know any of that setting out. All I knew setting out was that I wanted to write about these bathing ponds in Hampstead Heath. I had lived near them for a number of years, and I used to walk in the heath. And it was a kind of strange and lonely time in my life, and somehow all of that feeling got absorbed into that landscape of Hampstead Heath. And there are these bathing ponds there where people, many people are sort of die-hard bathers. They go there every day, no matter the weather. And so I simply wanted to write something about them. So I found myself writing this character who every day watches his wife disappear into these black holes and kind of sinks to the bottom, and he waits breathlessly for her to come up. And then at last her head breaks the surface. And I didn't know what that was about. I simply wanted to kind of be there or embody them. And then at some point, following them for some time, I realized, and here is this man who felt that there was some part of his wife that was always inaccessible to him, that she disappeared constantly on him in some deep way, curled up in herself, that he couldn't touch. And that began to be his story.
I think as much as I would like to go on asking questions, I think it's time to let people in the audience ask them. And I would like to first say that I don't regard you as an audience, you know. You're participants. And when you read the book, you'll be participating in it. You know, many of you have heard my voice. It's inevitable asking you for money for a radio station that I dearly, dearly love and appreciate being a part of. But more than I could appreciate a radio station, I have to say that I appreciate libraries. From the time when the school would ungenerously return me to the arms of a working mother, I was parked in the 42nd Street Library in the children's room, where they had the all of the Wizard of Oz books, you know, the ones that L. Frank Baum wrote with the colored plates. And other libraries just regarded them as series books. They didn't seem to trust books if they came in series. All series books were secretly Nancy Drew, you know, or the Bobbsey twins. And I'd wait and wait, reading and reading until my mother would come. And I literally grew up, if I got to be a bookworm, it was because I don't know why my parents didn't read. If I mentioned a book I wanted to have, it was a rule between my parents. They took me to the library. Immediately upon my father's return from home, if the local one was closed early that night, he'd take me to the further one. It was the most amazing thing. I really tested him, you know. And so now, as you know, the library is closed 2 days a week. And, you know, it's many of them are. And, you know, there is no secret trap door at the bottom of which is a pile of money. There's no Scrooge McDuck here, you know, dancing in the saved dollar bills that are not being spent on the library. It means it's up to us. We have to stop being the audience of the tragedy of the end of culture that is being precipitated around us. If you understand, you know, that any amount of money will do. In a way, it's as much about pledging yourself in a medieval sense. I pledge my troth. You are my beloved library. You're, you know, what I want my children to have. I want you to be there when my children need you. I want to be remembered. You know, I want my child to remember his father, because he'd always take me to the library. And I want to have a child who's always curious about a book. When I came home from fourth grade and I said I wanted to read Greek Mints. My parents were immigrants' children. They didn't know what myths were, Greek myths. When we went to the library, the librarian, the children's librarian said,
Greek mints, you mean like drachmae? Coinage? No, the gods and the goddesses. Oh, Greek myths.
I mean, libraries are always there to solve the questions that parents don't know. Children's librarians are better than Google. And so, if it's not completely obvious to you how to become a member, demand that you want to be told how you can become an effective and supportive member of the library. The library. Something we never thought we would lose in our times. Only we can save it. We, by being participants in it. So please, while asking your questions, project around the room all of the magnificent thoughts of membership. Who wants to start?
Hi. I was just wondering, when you were talking about the solitary relationship between the reader and the book, sort of got me thinking about Walter Benjamin and his essay on storytelling and how, you know, he actually thought that the book was a bad thing because it dislocated people from community, right? And what I was thinking about with regard to your writing is so much of it is about this kind of like collective memory that's a generation displaced almost, like the children of the children who survived the Holocaust or survived the bombing of Dresden. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little about the negotiation between the community's investment in storytelling as experience and the individual's investment. Sorry.
Well, Benjamin, of course, dedicated his life to books, so I don't know how truly he actually believed that. I mean, he lived and died by them, really. And, you know, I'm often told that I write about the Holocaust, but it's just simply not true. In the same way that it's not true that this book is about a desk. I realize that this is not what you're saying. I'm getting to the answer, don't worry. You're looking upset. What interests me is the idea of the reverberations that pass down through generations, the response to either historical tragedy or simply personal familial trauma. And sometimes it comes in the form of something we can obviously relate to or name in a simple word, which contains so much like the Holocaust, and sometimes it's much harder to touch. But I think I've written one scene that took place, you know, in sort of a short paragraph, which actually took place during the Holocaust. The rest is simply the aftermath, in a way. And I suppose what interests me is not simply how these things are passed down. Though that does interest me. And there's a metaphor, and Michael and I talked about this today, there's a metaphor, a moment in the book where a stone goes through the glass window. And it's a stone that I knew would be thrown in 1944 in Budapest that would go through the window of a study where a family was sitting. And at that moment, that family's life would cease to exist as it had existed forever because the Gestapo had arrived, this family would be arrested, the child would never see his parents again. And I kept thinking to myself, where does the stone land? Where does that stone land? If that life ceases to exist forever at that moment that it goes through the glass, where can it possibly land? And so the stone, which I didn't write about into the final pages of the book, keeps falling through the book. And so, yes, there's a sense of how does it affect and echo through these lives. But much more ultimately interesting to me is the idea of the recreation or reinvention of the self in the face of this kind of trauma or loss. To me, that is profoundly interesting. And again, I feel like I've been writing about this from the first novel, which is about a man who loses 24 years of his memory and has to recreate a coherent sense of self. And in The History of Love, of course, you have Leo Gursky, who reimagines someone back to life, who's constantly inventing things in order to survive. And this book takes its title from a story from Jewish history, which has to do with total reinvention of a people, of a religion, so that it can survive. So what interests me is this kind of willful imagination applied to something we don't often think of as something imagined. We think of a self being something that is formed or that is given to us in a way from our parents. But it isn't that at all. And in fact, it is in these moments of tremendous loss or difficulty where the light is shown on the fact that we are creations, self-creations, really. Nobody's curious about anything?
Hi. I think I remember in one of your interviews you were saying that you, every morning before you write, you read the news.
Do I? If I do, that was before I had children.
Oh, was it? Well, whether or not that's true, I think something I noticed in your fiction is that it definitely has, I guess, political undertones, although it's never editorial. I mean, I guess I'm thinking of, like, future emergencies. I was wondering if you could just talk about, like, what your relationship with current events or that sort of thing is.
Yeah, I mean, they almost never work themselves into the surface of the book, by which I mean sort of the narrative level, nor does, for example, the various stuff of our contemporary life. For whatever reason, I can't like write the word email in a novel, or God forbid, Facebook or something like that. And people are never drinking Coca-Colas or eating gummy bears. Somehow these objects, which somehow sort of announce contemporary existence of the moment just now, give me a kind of allergy in the work. And I think it has something to do with my feeling that books, which are sometimes applauded for being a reflection of how we live now, I couldn't imagine wanting anything. That's the last thing that I want from a book. I read the New York Times Magazine to find out how we live now, or I simply live now to find out how we live now. But I want from books this other thing, many other things, some of which we talked about tonight. But somehow to for example, if I were to read in the morning paper, if I still did that, about the economic crisis, and then were to go and somehow mention that in the work, in a moment that work would lose, for me, all of its depth and be somehow shrink to this thing that's just only on the surface. I mean, it's like, imagine somebody when towns became connected by trains and time became a unified idea, so that towns had to then have the same clock, whereas before it was kind of subjective. What if somebody wrote a novel all about that? We wouldn't be reading it now, really. But if somebody wrote a novel about perceptions of time, well, we'll always need to read that novel. We'll always want to read that novel because it goes to someplace much deeper.
Hi. You mentioned that you don't use the third person anymore, or you try not to use the third person anymore, and kind of piggybacking on that last comment that you made about not, it's kind of been announced that if you want to be a good novel, it has to be kind of recognizing what's going on right now, or kind of addressing what's happening. But I think that in the history of love, at least, I haven't read the new book yet, but I bought it.
You can ask the question.
Thank you. But I think that you're saying that you want to use the third person or not use the third person. It sounds like a way of negotiating your readers into, and I want to know if you agree with this, but into accepting a storyline that doesn't necessarily concern their self-centeredness, but also puts them in the center of what you're talking about. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It's not a sort of conscious choice. I'm just simply not attracted to third person because it gets between me and the thing I'm trying to write about. It throws me out of it. I feel somehow like I'm delivering some news to someone, and I'm there to kind of announce something. And this opportunity, which I've spoken about quite a lot tonight, I guess it's on my mind, but this sense of being able to this privilege of being able to step into a life. It's just third person, which can be wonderful. I love many third person novels, but for me as a writer, it it does just the opposite to me. It takes me farther away. I feel like I'm some sort of, I have an aerial position, and I don't want the aerial position. I want to be in the battleground, you know, down in the hole with the character.
Right. Is it difficult for you to inhabit the emotional life of your characters, or does it just depend on the character and the situation? Is that a difficult process?
Do you mean by difficulty, you mean is it hard emotionally, or is it hard to... I want for the characters or the writing to take me to places that are difficult. I seek that. I mean, I want to be thrown off balance. I want to be uncomfortable, and I want to have to face things that I don't necessarily have to, or I can avoid facing in life. And I feel like when that happens, there's a kind of tenderness and a kind of fragility that opens up, and it is, of course, it can be painful, but it's painful in that very good, wonderful, cathartic way that we find in writing and art, when we feel our attention is drawn to something and we're looking at it. We're forced to look at it, but we want to look at it. We're drawn to look at it in a way that we simply can't look at it in life. And so it's rewarding, I suppose.
A final question? Good.
I'd like to know, in relationship to what you read tonight, and as the mother of two children, how you feel about two children raised in the same household, how so different they can be, and usually are.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that. I have two boys, and we talked about the idea of writing about something by writing about it from the opposite end, and that part that I read to you tonight, it's always strange to read that in front of an audience, which I think is why I do it, because that scene, although the father had a very different take on it, a very different attitude than I did, but just simply a scene from my life. It was my older son, his discovery of death, and that observation of, you know, when we die, we'll be hungry, was his. And it just simply, I mean, my feeling as it unfolded, as a series of questions, will the children die, do I die, was sort of my own feeling. And it was something that I felt I had to write about. Now, as for the idea of two children who are so completely different, I only have two, so I don't know what happens when you then have three. And I don't think I'll find out. But there is a sense in which when people ask me what has surprised you about having children, it is that. It is just simply kind of unfathomable how they come, in a way, formed as people from the beginning. And I realize now that what we do as parents, among the many things we do, I mean, I think we bear witness to our children. We do so many things, but we just try to open a path for them where they can be that person they always were, and we encourage them a little bit to the left if we can, a little bit to the right, but not much more than that, because they really are in some deep way who they are, and we need to find out who that person is and respect who that person is and open a way for them. Yeah.
Thank you all very much for coming, and let's give a real hand.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.